Morning. This is a great clock because it almost never matters when you come in here. It says 9:30. So I know we're a little bit late. We'll get started. Commissioner Levy is here. He'll be in shortly. Want to say good morning to everybody. Need a motion and second for the approval of the minutes of the commission meeting of August 10th, 2016.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? That motion carries. Thank you. Now, get Bill's executive director report.
Great. Thank you very much. So for those of you who are new to Port Commission meetings, I just say that the executive director's report is a regular feature of the commission packet that is mailed out in advance. And I just take advantage of this opportunity to talk about a few things that have been going on over the course of the last month since the last commission meeting. And as is our kind of new tradition now, we start with an acknowledgement of the port's safety champions who are represented here on this screen. We have a new and improved, and I would say more aggressive, safety program here at the port. And these are this month's champions. And before I get started, let me just also say, as is the case now, I think, with all commission meetings, on the back table, you're going to find an evacuation map in the event of an emergency. If there is an emergency, please go out that door, follow the hallway down. We'll open the doors. We will walk down the 8 floors and collect ourselves right on the other side of the FAA tower, where the central utility plant is. So, Curtis, maybe you'd give us our brief safety message of the month.
I'll do that. Thank you, Bill. Good morning, commissioners. As you'll recall, last fall, the executive team set out on a more concerted effort to address safety issues at the port. And as a part of that effort, we created essentially a safety steering committee. That steering committee was made up of a few executives and senior managers. And that group went to visit some of our partner organizations who are especially good at safety, who have experience in port-related issues, including Alaska Airlines, Port of Seattle, and TriMet. One of the lasting impressions the team came away with in those visits was that safety really needs to be elevated in the organization if it's going to be a priority. And so, as an outgrowth of those discussions, we have taken the safety and loss control role in the port and assigned it to one of our senior executives, Stan Waters. Beginning earlier this month, that position reported to Stan. We think that sort of embedding safety at a more senior level in the organization will help us focus on it and also signal to the rest of the port how important it is to us as an executive team. Just so you know, for the months ahead, we've got a new set of priorities that we're really trying to dig into as an executive team and that Stan will be working with safety on. Four items. First, finalizing our framework for our safety management system. Second, we've got a long list of safety items, programs, trainings that we've had on the list running for some time, and we're really trying to prioritize that list so that we're hitting the important and most heavy impact items first. And then third and fourth, two items that we've added to our strategic plan this summer, creating a roadmap and vision for the safety program that helps managers lead and drive improvements in safety within their department, essentially, again, returning to this framework. And second, creating an environment where each employee promotes safety as a core value of the port. So we really want to make sure that safety is part of our regular meeting conversations, it's part of our incentive program and port share, and it's really part of how we act, how we work in as a culture and as a group. So that, Bill, is my safety message for the morning. More
great
of an update, really.
All right. Thank you. Last week ended the Superfund comment period. The EPA has released their proposed plan, which is kind of a more like a general outline for cleaning up the lower Willamette, which runs essentially from the Broadway Bridge on the Willamette to pretty much the confluence with the Columbia River. this is a moment, I think, for us and everybody else who has an interest in the Willamette to just pause and take a deep breath and acknowledge first the extraordinary effort that has been undertaken to get to this point. We ourselves have incurred, you know, north of $100 million worth of expense to get to this point, the testing, the sampling, and all the work that's been done to get to this point of having a proposed plant. Lots of comments, I'm sure, have been received by the EPA, and they'll take some period of time now to absorb those and then to presumably issue a record of decision for the Superfund. They hope by the end of the year we're not quite as confident that that'll happen, but it's certainly in the very foreseeable future. And it is a big, big moment. This is really over 15 years of effort has gone into kind of this moment. And we are among many who I think are really ready to get started with this project. We offered what I think are constructive comments. I know that we have shared those with you both in detail and in summary. You got a little feedback at the last commission meeting from people who maybe didn't think it was quite as constructive, but we do, and we're ready to get started. And as far as we're concerned, we'd like to get started sooner rather than later. Cost-effective ways to reach consensus goals is also very important for us. I think, as you know, and I think increasingly the public will know, we're not able to use revenues generated here at the airport in the cleanup. The airport is carved out essentially by the FAA, and the rules and regulations associated with revenue diversion prevent us from using these resources for something like the cleanup of the Lower Willamette. So we're relying entirely on our general fund resources, which are largely generated from the businesses that we operate in the general fund, from the selling and the development of industrial land and the operation of our marine terminals. So it's an issue for us. We did indicate the EPA that we're not interested, as was suggested at the last commission meeting, in hosting the confined disposal facility at Terminal 4. The adjoining neighborhoods have indicated a great deal of anxiety about that prospect. And the CDF, confined disposal facility, would have to be operated for a long, long time, and we're just not interested in having protracted conflict or even suggesting such a thing when the feasibility of the CDF itself is far from known or being determined. So we essentially took that off the table. So a big moment. Now I think things are going to get quiet for a period of time, and then sometime probably not long after the first of the year, we can expect the EPA to issue the record of decision, which is kind of the next milestone in this project, and not long thereafter we'll begin a process of very serious negotiations with the various parties in the EPA about specific pieces of work. This is a lifetime project, I think I can safely say. It's big, it's complicated, and for us it's very, very important. Happy to report, as I think I emailed all of you, the Airline Pilots Association International has presented PDX with the 2015 Airport of the Year Award for our continued collaboration and partnering with pilots on important safety and construction issues. This is something that may seem a little obscure to members of the public, but there is a tremendous amount of interaction between the people who operate the airport and the people who use the airport. So ourselves, And our folks out in the field and the airline pilots and the airlines themselves. So this is a big deal for us, and we're excited about it because it is obviously central to our mission here, operating the airport not only in a way that is pleasing to the general public and to customers, but to the airlines themselves. So we're very pleased about that. We also received the three Trip Advisor Traveler's Choice Awards for Best Large U.S. Airport, Best Airport Dining, and Best Airport Shopping. And this is an affirmation that we've had from Travel and Leisure magazine as well overall. So it's great to have some additional recognition in that regard. The Connect Oregon program that you've certainly heard us talk about in the past, which I think has been in existence in Oregon for now over a decade. The port, it's a lottery-funded program established by the legislature, as I said, about a decade ago to focus on non-road-related transportation, so aviation, rail, marine, but not roads. And we historically have done, I think, very well with this program, probably over $100 million worth in total over that decade. And we were awarded a $2.6 million grant along with our tenant auto warehousing company to fund part of a $7 million expansion of auto handling facilities in the Rivergate Industrial District near Terminal 6. This is primarily to create capacity for a rapidly growing export business that auto warehousing is handling through the Ford Motor Company. You know, exports are obviously an incredibly important part of the country's economy, but particularly so here in Oregon. We are export-oriented. These Fords represent just a great story. This is not only an industry, which appeared to be in tremendous trouble in the United States only a few years ago, but the idea that we would be making cars in the United States or in Canada and then exporting them to other parts of the world is not something that many people talked about 5 or 6 years ago and is today the fastest growing part of our auto business. And one of the really interesting features of this business is that the Chinese, who are receiving many of these Ford automobiles for whatever reason, do not allow the vehicle processing, which is the work that's done immediately prior to the delivery to the dealer and the end user in China, to happen in China. So it happens at Terminal 6. These are great jobs. They're union jobs. And both Ford and AWC see this as a significant and growing part of their business. So we're really pleased with it. As a part of our 125th anniversary celebration, this being the port's 125th anniversary, 75th anniversary of PDX, we've been on a series of round-the-state visits, typically hosting reception, and then after people have had a drink and something to eat, we make them sit down and listen to our story. And it's gone very, very well. We began in the Central Willamette Valley in Albany. We had another one in Troutdale here. We've been to Medford, and we had a team that was just over in Central Oregon. And of course, and we will be going soon to Pendleton. And depending on where you are, the subjects are a little different in places like Central Oregon, but particularly in the Central Willamette Valley, there's great interest in what's happening in the world of containerization. I'll have more to say that about that in a moment. But people are very interested in what's happening here at the airport. This is Oregon's airport as well, for the most part. We're working very closely with the smaller airports around the country to hopefully induce more air service to places like Klamath Falls, where we'll be restarting service soon. So it's been, it's just a good excuse, frankly, for us to get out and interact with people in areas of the state that don't wake up every morning thinking about the Port of Portland, and it's been terrific. One other really interesting little factoid, We have a fairly substantial letter of credit here at the port that's associated with a series of financial transactions that were done many years ago on our not inconsiderable debt here at the airport. The letter of credit was expiring, and so we went back out to the marketplace. And interestingly enough, by far the most competitive proposal that we received was from the Industrial Commercial Bank of China, ICBC, which most people don't know is actually the largest bank in the world. They gave us a letter of credit on $82 million of variable rate debt, and it was going to save us about $200,000 a year. And the interesting thing is it's the first letter of credit of this type that they've issued in the United States. So it's an indication that this is not just a global business, but they're going to become much more engaged here in the U.S., and we helped open the door for them. So we're pleased with that. Penn Air is beginning Klamath Falls on October 5th. Penn Air is actually an state of Alaska-based carrier that provides service typically to smaller markets. They fly a small 40-seat Saab aircraft, ground-loaded, and it's really ideal for some of the small markets in Oregon that have lost service over the course of the last few years. Klamath Falls was particularly challenging because the TSA indicated they were reluctant to allocate resources in the way of TSA officers there to do the screening, without which air service is very challenging, and a local person actually stepped up to underwrite that, and so they'll have a full TSA operation in Klamath Falls. The service will start, as I said, on October 5th, and Klamath Falls has been without air service for some time, meaning that people from Klamath Falls who want to go somewhere literally have to drive over the mountains to Medford, which in the winter months is can be very challenging. And we were reminded by a variety of the folks in Klamath Falls, just how important this air service is to them in terms of their local economy. And so we're excited about it. And our air service development team and our airport operations folks have just recently hosted a meeting with airport managers from other airports in the state to explore similar opportunities. And I think it's a great service that we can provide because we know it based on our experience here. Airports are important to the health of local communities, and whatever we can do to help stimulate that service is going to be terrific. So we're very excited about that. So a slightly different matter of airport operations coming up on September 24th. We're sponsoring the PDX Runway Run on the South Runway. We'll be closing it for a brief period, not too long, just enough for 2,100 people to make it up and back on the South Runway. We've got a large contingent of runners and walkers, and it's a kind of an exciting way to just open the airport up and give people an experience that they're never going to have again, to physically get out and experience what a runway looks like standing on your own 2 feet. So it'll be kind of fun, and we're looking good. We've got only a few spots left. Hoping to fill all of those. Cornfoot Road, which is right over here on the other side of the guard base, is going to be closed in late September, early October for maybe up to 45 days, putting in a huge stormwater main there. The old one's about 80 years old. This is critically important for airport drainage, the airport airfield. Most months of the year actually sits below the level of the Columbia River, so the water table here is about a finger deep, and this is a very important piece of infrastructure. So it'll be inconvenient, but this is very, very important. And then finally, a new fence will be installed by a private landowner on West Hayden Island, right in front of ours. At the end of the cul-de-sac, this will block access to the port path to the beach on West Hayden Island, but it will also prevent people from trespassing on the property. And if you've been following the news at all, you can just imagine the number of campsites that have popped up on West Hayden Island. When we do our periodic cleanups out there, that's, you know, a large part of what we're finding, to be honest. So it's a big challenge. It's an enormous piece of property. It's, you know, 800 acres that's not policed on a regular basis. So we're going to keep a very close eye on that. And that concludes, well, I guess I would just add one other thing. In the 30 days subsequent from our last meeting, our major carrier in this market, prior to the closure of Terminal 6, Hanjin, has entered bankruptcy in Korea. Bankruptcy, they've sought bankruptcy protection there and here, and in the other 60 or so countries where they operate. It's a mess. The local trade press pretty much suggests that they don't really expect that Hanjin will return as a viable enterprise. Many of their assets are actually in the process of being sold now. kind of the speculation is that at the time of the bankruptcy, they had as many as 500,000 containers in transit somewhere in the world, which is a problem. If you have cargo contained in one of those containers, it could be months, frankly, before you see it. And if you're an importer and you're expecting cargo for the Christmas season, I hope you've got other alternatives available to you. And if you're an export, you've got a perishable product, say onions, which is big in this market, then you're going to have dried onions, I guess, by the time you get your container back. This really is the tip of the iceberg in an industry which has been troubled for some time. Really, none of these carriers, and there are 23 in the Trans-Pacific trades, are making money today. Hanjin was probably in the most dire condition, but there are several others that aren't far behind them. And so I think this is a story that we're going to continue to see played out. And it only goes to suggest that even if Terminal 6 were operating today and these labor issues were resolved, which I hope they will be soon, the underlying business that supports that terminal is in a state of real turmoil. And the likelihood of seeing service return quickly is not high. So it's a challenge. We're on top of it. We've got people going to some of these important global shipping conferences to really get a better feel for what the pulse of the industry is. But it's going to be kind of a wild ride. That concludes my remark.
Questions? Comments? Motion to approve the executive director report?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. Thanks. Thanks, Bill. And Vince, you got a general discussion item about our annual environmental review. Good morning.
Good morning. Every year, the port funds projects, programs that enhance and move forward our environmental goals and objectives. And in fact, one of the agenda items today has an environmental component to it. And once a year, we always like to make sure we come and report out to you on our progress towards meeting our environmental goals and objectives. We also do that through an environmental report, through our website, and with our community groups as well. So today, Phil Ralston here, he's our Director of Environmental Policy and Operations, and he's going to give you an update just on the status of how we're doing on our goals and objectives that we've set.
Great. Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning.
In your briefing materials, you received the written report for last year's progress toward meeting our objectives and targets. And you also received a copy of the objectives and targets we've adopted for this current fiscal year that you'll hear a report on next year. So those copies of those are also found on our public website and an hard copy at the back of the room for anybody who would like those. So given that you've got those documents in front of you, what I'd like to do today is simply highlight a couple of the items and not go into excruciating detail on every single one of the objectives and targets, and hopefully have some time for some question and comments at the end. But first, I'd like to just take a real brief moment to describe how these objectives and targets fit into our environmental program. And the Port Commission adopted an environmental policy that is still pertinent and guides us. How we implement that policy is through a collection of processes and tools that collectively make up our environmental management system depicted in this Plan, Do, Check, Act structure. And you see all the various elements of the EMS there. The objectives and targets are set in the plan quadrant, and we execute those throughout the year, and then we report on them both internally to our own colleagues and management and externally to the public and to you folks in our check and act quadrants of the EMS Plan, Do, Check, Act cycle. So each of the we have five environmental programs that actually help us implement our policy, and we'll go through each of those briefly and highlight one of the targets from each of those. Those programs include air, energy, natural resources, water, and waste, and they're administered by a professional subject matter expert, and every year we set action plans that support meeting objectives and targets. Oftentimes these targets are multi-year. Sometimes they span well more than 5 years. Other times they're single-year targets. And what we like to do is make sure that we report out to you folks on our progress toward meeting our commitments that support our targets. So today what we're going to do is just highlight the progress. This is a scorecard of how we've done this past year. We adopted 15 targets and actions. We completed 13, which is relatively typical for a year. Oftentimes, we don't complete all of them for various reasons. It might be technical. It might be financial. It might be that we run into issues that we weren't aware of. And some of these targets are stretch goals, so some of them aren't always easy to achieve. For the targets to span multiple years, if there's an action that support those and we complete it, we put that in a complete column. This past year, we had two commitments that we weren't able to fully complete. And when we have those, we reevaluate whether they're still pertinent, if we should go forward and complete those or not. In this case, both of those we're going to go ahead and finish out. One of those has to relates to trying to get unleaded fuel in use at Hillsborough Airport, and the other has to do with water leak detection and repair of water distribution systems at various facilities. And both of those have complexities that prevented us from completing our commitments this year, but we're planning to continue to pursue those in the next year. So what I'd like to do now is just touch on a highlight from each of the programs. David Breen leads our air program, and the port utilizes emission inventories and aspects and impacts analyses to set our air program priorities for emission reductions. And the Ports Commission set an ambitious goal in 2009 to reduce port-controlled direct and indirect greenhouse gas emissions by 15% below 1990 baseline levels by 2020. We're at 63% below that 1990 baseline. Our goal was 15% below, so we've surpassed that target significantly. And what's significant to note is this was done at our baseline year. We had about 6 million passengers flow through PDX in 1990. Our emissions are 63% below even that year, even though we've more than doubled the passenger flow through at PDX in 2014. So it's a significant reduction. Similar situation could be said for diesel emission reductions. Last year, for diesel emission reductions, we've reduced our emissions by 71% below 2000 baseline year. So because we exceeded the goal by so much, which was a 25% goal, we actually updated the goal and we have a new, more stringent goal to reduce our emissions by 75%. So that's an example where we review our goals if we've exceeded or surpassed or met them, and we look for a more difficult, stringent stretch goal to look toward in the future. The way we do this is really through the use of and purchasing renewable credits, renewable power credits, the use of alternative fuels, use of cleaner engines, and operational efficiencies. Now, looking forward, one of the things that we do know is that about 95% of the greenhouse gas emissions that the port enables actually are generated by aircraft, not by port operations themselves. So we have set a new target to help our air carriers reduce the aircraft-related greenhouse gas emissions at PDX by 25% from a 2010 level by the year 2035. Now, this is a little different target since it's not operations that we control. So we're reaching out to our airline partners, and we will work with them to meet their greenhouse gas emission reduction goals as well. Our target is consistent with many of the airlines' targets. Now, what does that mean in practicality at PDX? It means that we're going to make sure that the fueling infrastructure here at PDX can accommodate sustainable aviation biofuels through piping, valving, storage, that kind of thing. And we're also looking for ways to reduce the premium cost of these sustainable aviation biofuels using some financing mechanisms and to try to bring the price down to help them, to help accelerate the use and the purchase of biofuels sooner than later. Right now, biofuels are about twice the cost of standard aviation fuels. So moving on.
A quick question. Can you sort of explain the impact that the purchase of clean energy credits have on the overall result? I want to make sure I understand if it's actual practice that reduces and lower emissions or if it's an offset because of the...
Very good question. And actually, this chart helps explain that. We have both. So when we talk about our emission reductions, a large amount of that is due to actual operational efficiencies and conservation supplemented by the purchase of renewable energy credits, which can be viewed as sort of an offset. So what that does is we spend this year roughly $40,000 to purchase 100% of our electrical power equivalent as renewable energy. And that offsets, I don't know if Franco's in the room, but it offsets roughly 30%. It's the equivalent of about 30% of our reduction. If we're ever going to get to carbon neutrality, we're going to have some level of offsets.
Okay. Thank you.
And we can provide far more detail if you'd like on the numbers.
Thank you.
Sure. Our energy program is led by Franco Martinez, and we have a long-term energy reduction goal, energy consumption reduction goal, which is 20% by 2020 over the 2011 baseline. And currently, relative to that 20% consumption reduction goal, we're at 16.7%. We have about three or four more years to try to achieve that 20% target. And again, the way we're going to achieve those targets is through energy conservation projects. Primarily, an example would be the relighting at PDX using LED lighting has saved us a lot of energy on the order of 1.3 million kilowatt hours and the equivalent of over 1,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide and a fair amount of money. So these energy conservation projects that we have on tap and budgeted and programmed into our capital project will help us drive progress toward meeting these targets. Looking at our natural resources program led by Dana Green, one of the projects I'd like to highlight for you is the Government Island Upland Grassland Mitigation Project. In 2012, during our PDX Airport Futures long-range planning process, The port committed to initiating a 50-acre upland grassland enhancement project on Government Island, which is in the Columbia River right across from PDX, in advance of impacts from development at the airport. The intent and the primary goal is to create a site that provides habitat, structure, and function necessary to support upland grassland-associated wildlife, primarily birds and pollinators. So over the course of the last few years, we've prepared the land, seeded it with native species. It's just about mature. We're starting monitoring and verification in the field with various partners, including the Xerces Society, Audubon, City of Portland, BES, and others. And what this is essentially a field trial in anticipation of the next couple of upland grassland mitigation site enhancements that we're going to have to do in response to development on the west end of the airport. So this is the first 50 acres. We anticipate that in the next couple of years, we're going to have to create another 100 acres, and we have a capacity for about 300-acre mitigation site out there. Looking ahead, we're looking forward to completing the mitigation, the wetland mitigation site at TRIP, which is at over 80 acres, one of the largest wetland mitigation sites developed in Oregon. And we're also looking to getting an agreement from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on a mitigation site downriver in the Columbia River for the threatened streetcar and lark, which can be found on the west end of the airport here and also at our Rivergate properties. And without that mitigation, that will constrain some of our operations and our ability to develop some of the sites that are in industrial reserve. From a water resources program point of view, this is kind of an interesting photo. This is a photo of our PDX maintenance staff member, Tim Cooper, demonstrating how to clean out storm drains for industrial and commercial applications and being filmed by KOIN Channel 6. And last year, the port joined forces with KOIN and Clean Water Program partners, including Metro City, Gresham, and others, to develop some PSAs around educating the public on how to make sure that we keep our stormwater clean. So two PSAs were filmed at PDX. Others were filmed around the city, and those are shown on YouTube, KOIN website, and others, and there have been over 9.5 million hits on these things. So it's just a little something that we do in terms of public education and participating with partners on preventing pollution in our stormwater system-wide. Looking forward, though, really what we're focusing on is leak detection and repair of our water distribution system to save water resources and save money. And Terminal 4 is a focal point for that. And also to make sure that we're using non-potable water for non-potable uses, for instance, at the quick turnaround car wash, where we are putting in water supply well, and we will be capturing rainwater to supply about 50,000 gallons a day for the QTA, and using only about 250 gallons of potable water a day for human consumption purposes. So it's a very important goal that we separate and preserve potable water, high quality potable water, for its highest and best use, and not use those resources for non-potable industrial uses. Finally, our waste minimization program, managed by Stan Jones, has a long-term target to achieve 90% or greater landfill waste diversion at port facilities by June 2018. So last year we accomplished a number of actions and activities to drive forward to that, and I'd like to highlight just some of the successes here and some of the challenges. Within the port-controlled operations, we're at 95% diversion from landfill. That means the materials are either reused, repurposed, or recycled, or used for energy. That includes construction and demolition waste. Taking that out of the equation, we're at about 58%. In this building, we're at about 76% diversion from landfill, and as we reduce the amount of paper that Metro won't take for recycling, paper towels and some other specialty papers, that number should go up. At the terminal, overall, there's about 10 tons of garbage generated a day from aircraft and public use. Right now, there's about a 31% recycling diversion rate. There's opportunities there, particularly with the deplaned waste off aircraft. But a really bright spot is our concession partners, our restaurants, food and beverage folks, are at about 62% diversion rate and are increasing those numbers quite rapidly. So we're very proud of that partnership. So really, I hope these highlights give you a sense of sort of the breadth and the depth of the kinds of activities that we work on here at the port and the objectives and targets. And just as a last note, I'd like to share with you some of the recognitions we've received in the past year from different entities. And one we're particularly proud of is the one from the North Northeast Business Association for the Environmental Equity Award. And we're proud of that because those are neighbors that recognize what we do every day. And finally, I'd like to recognize Dorothy Sperry of our staff and her leadership for making sure that we maintain our ISO 14001 certification of our environmental management system. To our knowledge, we continue to be the only consolidated port in North America that has all its operations, all its business lines certified to the ISO 14001 standard. And with that, I'll conclude my comments and open it up to questions.
So, questions or comments?
One question. The carpet, who bought them?
Who bought the carpet?
The used ones.
Well, the public. There are a lot of people in the public that bought the carpet. It was given away as well to nonprofits. And I couldn't tell you the exact number in the split about the purchase versus the giveaways, but that was a very unique experience that was recognized worldwide. Portland has definitely landed on the map for that experience.
We did an RFP, and I think we awarded it to, four different providers that then had different ways to distribute it out and created other products out of it. So I think there were four different companies, that we gave it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Everything from luggage to other flooring, ground up and reused fibers, wide range.
Yeah, Phil, I just want to thank you and your team. This is a very good report, and it really makes me feel good that we're moving the ball forward and we're meeting our targets. In fact, what I see here, we exceed them. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I concur. Comments from a fellow commissioner, and would want you to take just a second and mention some of the community groups, the consumer groups who have been a partner in elements of this work, because I know there's huge interest in people sort of objecting or promoting shared objectives around some of this.
Yeah, great question. First, I'd like to say that, you know, these accomplishments are really based on everybody at the port, whether they're in business lines, operations, maintenance, support services, and with the support of management. There are, you know, hundreds of decisions and actions taken every year that result in these accomplishments. Externally, in terms of partnerships, we have a number of advisory committees with representatives from neighborhoods, from NGOs, from advocacy groups, whether it's Audubon, federal state agencies, Northwest or Northeast neighborhood associations, that routinely work with us to advise us on what their priorities and what their concerns are. So we take those into account year round during our normal processes and our normal meetings with them. We also partner with organizations like the Xerce Society around natural resources and pollinators, and they have a lot of expertise that they bring to the table. Portland State University is a partner of ours and has been for at least 12 years on our waste minimization program, the Community Environmental Services Group there. Basically allows us to work with four students a year from their group, two grad students typically and two undergrads, that basically implement our waste minimization program by providing a lot of research, data gathering and interpretation, but more importantly, technical assistance to our tenants and our customers here. I could go on and on. We have a long list of partners. Audubon Society in particular works with us in our wildlife hazard management program. When we trap birds, red-tailed hawks in particular, during different times of the year, or other birds that may be injured that we are able to collect, we work with Audubon to rehabilitate and have those birds put back out into nature. And they advise us on how we should work with various species and handle those birds. So it's a pretty wide range, and we can get you a really comprehensive list, but we try to stay engaged, and we try to partner because we all have common goals that we need to work together on.
Great. Thank you.
So I've got a question, Phil, and appreciate, as others have, the work that's been done and a great presentation here. We've also heard, as part of the port's programs on health and wellness, for example, that it's maybe easier to see in that program. Not only do you have outcomes that are great for employees, but there's a dollar calculation that can be made from the benefits of those investments. People are healthier, they're able to work better, they work longer, they're happier, whatever, as well as insurance rates go down. If we look on the environmental side, and some of the presentation and some of what I know you do seems to lend itself to that sort of calculation, the monetization of what we do and the choices we make, because mm-hmm. I assume you have a budget that you work from.
Right.
How much of that is there, and how difficult is it to have the data to make choices based not only on feel good but and doing the right thing, but dollars and cents?
Yeah, very good question. In some areas, there's a lot of data, and other areas, there's not. But where there is, in particular, is around energy conservation. So our priorities are set based on a couple of things. One is reducing consumption of actual energy, reducing our greenhouse gases, but also what's the best return on for the investment. So we have very clear return on investment calculations and results for our energy conservation programs. So, for example, the LED lighting, there's a $400,000 a year return on that, and each project has an ROI. For air quality, it's for climate change in particular and greenhouse gas emission reductions, the port hasn't adopted an internal price for carbon. But when the state of Oregon or the federal government adopts a carbon tax or a cap and trade program, there will be a more explicit price and cost that could be used to calculate. So right now we're positioning ourselves to create avoided costs by reducing our emissions, and we don't know what that would be. If we were to fully go to a carbon neutral port, depending on the quality of the credits and offsets we would have to purchase, it would be between $200,000 and $400,000 per year. So we know some of these things. On the waste minimization program, we're saving about $120,000 a year by recycling and getting a rebate back from the recyclers on basically a shared revenue. So that helps offset the cost of our contract with Portland State University, for instance, and having four students out here. So, and certainly in water conservation and the rest of it, we can calculate those things. And those might be good things to add to our report next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Thank you. Well, thanks very much again.
Yeah, thank you.
The first agenda item is marketing reimbursement agreement, Delta Airlines, and David Zilke will do that presentation along with Keith, I guess.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So a little under the radar, I would say, with our air service development strategies has been
that we are very underserved to London. It's been kind of top of the list for a long time. We've been rating for the right partner at the right time, and David and team this year were very fortunate to work with Delta Airlines, with Virgin Atlantic, to put this new service together. It will start next year. David will get into the details. This is a marketing reimbursement agreement. The agenda item that's before you, $650,000, and it's part of what I'll call the more conventional incentive package that airports provide for these types of transoceanic services. So with that, I'll ask David to summarize the item.
Thanks, Keith. The $650,000, along with our fee waiver program, provided really a competitive tool for us to go out and compete, and you really have to compete for service to London. Other airports around the country were offering multi-million dollar revenue guarantees. We chose not to do that. We felt we had the strongest business case, and we have what we think is a very unique and strong partnership with Delta, who already serves Tokyo and Amsterdam on a year-round basis. So we thought that put us in the strongest position to get the service, and we are right. We got the service from Delta. Why London? It's the largest aviation market in the world. 150 million people travel to and from London and its Heathrow and the combined airports around it. So it's very sought after. And the other two largest markets in the world are Tokyo and New York. And we already have year-round service to both Tokyo and to New York. So we're thrilled to be able to add London to that mix as well. A little history in terms of kind of how this came about. 5 years ago, we had a meeting at Avanti Destination offices downtown Portland with our stakeholders, which is Travel Oregon, Travel Portland, Nike, Adidas, travel agencies such as Azamano, AAA, wholesalers. And we had a very robust discussion, and they made it really clear to us that we really want London and or Paris service. And of course, as the port, we take the lead on that. We took a very strategic approach to it. You don't want to just go out and get any airline that doesn't complement your other service. We wanted to make sure it was the right airline at the right time. As Bill likes to say, we don't recruit service unless the market will sustain it. We think in the last year, we saw that the market had grown to the point where we could sustain London service. We started talking to Delta, and it was very fortuitous that they took a 49% position in Virgin Atlantic, so they had a very strong interest in the London market itself. And so clearly that was our focus. We started out, Bill and Rick and I went to London with our consultant in March talking to Virgin Atlantic, and it quickly pivoted to a Delta discussion. And so we were thrilled to be able to secure the service. So again, our role at the port was to make sure it's the right airline at the right time with the right aircraft. And it's a 767. It's Delta's smallest transoceanic airplane. 777s, 747s are way too big, and we wouldn't be able to sustain that. So the 767 was the right airplane with the right carrier. We are now meeting with those same stakeholders. Ironically, we're back meeting at Avanti Destinations again. Curtis is part of that team. We call it Team Heathrow. And we are developing a very robust, broad campaign to support Delta's efforts to build awareness and demand for the flight. There's corporate outreach. There's promotions throughout the marketplace. On November 14th, the airport will come alive with our Holidays Take Flight promotion. It'll be all about London. Delta employees will be wearing Delta pins and hats at that time. There'll be a unique social media campaign launching in the spring. And our travel partners, Travel Oregon and Travel Portland, who are so important to us, will be investing over $500,000 in London, building demand on the inbound side into our hotels and our destinations throughout the state. Rick Izao, who is in the back here, and I saw a sneak peek of the advertising campaign Delta will be launching next month. It's robust. It's unique. It's innovative. It'll be wallscapes, billboards, digital campaigns that can actually track corporate users that they want to identify and secure service and support for the flight. And so we're very excited about the fact that our marketing dollars, the Delta, will be able to use those very effectively to build demand for the flight. I should say that the cost of the $650,000 is spread between the airline and the port cost centers, and our airlines all support our campaign, our incentive, our recruitment efforts, because ultimately additional service reduces the rates and charges for all the carriers or PDX. So it's a very comprehensive, but it's a campaign, and it's a program that all of our carriers support. So certainly as staff would hope that the commission would support our recommendation today.
Thank you. Any questions, comments?
I have a question. First off, I totally support it. I just was curious, how much is Delta investing? Is it way more than $650,000 and we're just reimbursing that piece?
Well, you know, Delta has the airplane. Mm-hmm. We don't have any airplanes. Yeah. And, you know, airplanes are anywhere from $150 to $200 million. So they have a huge capital investment. For a market like ours, they rely on our support. They have staff in the marketplace. They certainly do their own advertising on a national and a global level, but they don't really put, they're not in a position to put significant resources into the local market from an advertising standpoint. So that was part of our negotiation with them. We would commit this in exchange for them bringing the airplane to the market. So I don't know if you want to comment on that at all, Bill.
Yeah, you know, this is... We've been at this for a while, so we first began serious international air service recruitment back in 2001 and 2002. And that's what really became apparent early on, and that is these large global carriers, particularly in that day it was Lufthansa, now it's Delta, they don't really have the resources to do marketing in small local especially point-to-point markets like ours. It's one thing if they're, you know, it's Atlanta, which is their big hub. We're not a hub. And so if we're not doing it, it won't get done. That doesn't mean they won't bring the plane or they won't start the service, but this is a little extra insurance to be sure that it's successful. And I think, you know, the important thing to note is that the other carriers support this relationship. You think, well, gee, how do they feel about using this money to support a potential competitor? And they like it because it helps solidify the success of a carrier whose success means a reduction in overall operating costs for everybody at the airport. So Delta, you know, who knows? They may choose on their own to add a little if they see something being particularly successful. And by the way, they get a pretty good feel for that right away. If we do a campaign, their IT system is so sensitive and robust, they get a sense about what works and what doesn't. And we'll get a pretty good feel for that. So that's been our approach. It was really unique and cutting edge when we started. And to be honest, we're kind of behind the eight ball now. We are not as aggressive as a lot of other airports are, particularly non-hub airports like ours who are recruiting, which kind of, and I don't like to be in that position. We're always, we like to think of ourselves as leaning forward. And now I think we're just kind of standing tall and maybe not leaning as far forward in all of this.
And, you know, Delta, we are the only market, only non-hub market that Delta provides year-round transoceanic service. So we're really a niche to them, but our flights make money for them, and they're committed to staying in the market. And we're prepared to continue to work very closely with them to make sure that not only London works, but the Tokyo-Amsterdam flights continue as well to meet the needs of the entire marketplace.
Well, historically as well, Delta, I mean, to your concern, Linda, Delta, when they got into the market for the Amsterdam flight, as well as maintaining the Tokyo flight, there was an investment made by the port and partners, and they have stayed.
Yes.
And when you talk with them, without that lift to begin with, mm-hmm. they wouldn't be here. So, I mean, it is a risky business, for sure. But our folks have had really good experience with Delta and others in terms of picking the right service, the right provider, and spending judiciously the money. So.
And Keith and Curtis and Rick and I were in Atlanta just a few months ago having dinner and meeting with the Delta leadership. And clearly they Portland works for them, and they're absolutely intending to stay committed to the marketplace. But our job is to make sure that the flights sustain and are profitable and successful. So otherwise, they could reallocate that asset somewhere else very quickly.
You know, I got a question about this yesterday that I think it's useful just to get on the record, and that is, what guarantee do we get that they'll be here tomorrow? And the answer is, we get no guarantee. And that's the reason why, way back, so this is like 13, 14 years ago, we kind of sat down and looked at the mirror and developed a strategy for recruitment, particularly international recruitment, but also domestic recruitment, and kind of built a list of points, beginning with, we're not going to try to recruit service that we don't really think can be successful. And that seems like kind of a no-brainer, but the reality is, airports out there who are not hubs and who are hungry and who've had declines maybe, or they're under pressure to add service, have a reputation in the industry, in the airline industry, for saying and doing anything they need to get more service. They'll throw money at it, they'll do this, they'll do that. And we just decided, we're not going to do that, because I can tell you, based on personal experience, when we went to Northwest Airlines, which was later acquired by Delta, to start Tokyo, the very first question that we faced was, well, what happened to Delta? You know, why aren't they doing it anymore? And I think, so we said, okay, good, we're not going to do that. We buy the data, and it's very expensive. We hire a really talented outside professional firm to manipulate and squeeze that data so that we get a really good picture about what success looks like. We have engaged the business travel community very aggressively here. So companies like Nike and Intel and others made upfront commitments to use the service, and initially really solid financial commitments. So all these things in place so that we can look at ourselves and go, you know, London is a really good example. If it were a slam dunk, somebody would have been doing it a long time ago. You know, there's an element of risk involved. We now think the risk is worth this effort on our part. As I said, if it were obvious, somebody would have been doing it. It's only recently kind of grown to a level where we think it's got a shot, but it is not an easy one. So we're all, you know, David and the team have connected with the whole travel community here to put our shoulder to the wheel to really make this thing work, because we don't want to have to face that question with some other carrier down the road, what happened to Delta when they tried London? You know, it didn't work. So we throw money at it, but we throw it in a really intelligent way. We've had a lot of experience about the kind of advertising, for example, or the programs that work, and we've got a pretty good feel for that. And Travel Oregon, Travel Portland have really stepped up, and we are joined at the hip with all of them now. And the business travel community has also just been terrific with this, which makes a very big difference.
Yes, Commissioner.
Oops. What's the frequency of the service?
It'll be 4 days a week for 4 months. So it'll be May to October, and that's called seasonal. And our goal and our discussion with Delta is to broaden it in year two to possibly 6 months and add frequencies. And the long-term goal is to support it on a year-round basis. Now, the market is much smaller in the deep winter to Europe than it is in the summer. It's roughly half the size. So there's less tourism going, and both business travel continues, but less tourism traffic to Europe as well as inbound from Europe. So we want to make sure that we add the frequencies, add the days, add the seasonality to a broader shoulder at the right time. So Delta will be analyzing that very carefully, and our consultant as well. So, but 4 days a week for 4 months.
Brexit may complicate this a little, although I could make an argument that it actually probably improves it, because, you know, depending on which way things go, this is not a service that's intended to take people beyond London. So this will be a primarily O&D, origination, destination service, and arguably that could grow and the London market. We'll see how things materialize here. But
Tom?
Yeah, Tom. Thank you. Very good presentation.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah. Very quick. You said earlier in your presentation that in addition to this $650,000 reimbursement incentive, there will be about $500,000 used to promote inbound traffic.
Right.
Could you give us a flavor of that and how that is going to work?
Sure. A small portion of that is going to come out of the money we've invested with Delta. We'll be working with Delta and Virgin Atlantic in London. A big part of that I was talking about actually was Travel Oregon and Travel Portland, who will be investing their dollars in major media, consumer campaigns, and then travel trade, where they're bringing in travel writers into Portland to see the market and build demand and awareness and enthusiasm to come to Portland and to Oregon as well. So it's
and that money comes from room taxes.
Hmm. All right. Thank you.
So is there a motion and second to approve the recommendation?
So, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The item is the public improvement contract for air conditioning on the jetways, I think.
Yeah, this is one of those environmental projects that we talked about a little bit earlier. Today. And what this project is all about, it's a public improvement contract to add preconditioned air, PCA units on the loading bridges here. These heat and cool the air. The value to this project is that by us doing this through our systems rather than them plugging into the airline auxiliary power unit and running off the engines of the aircraft. So because we're lowering emissions here, we're also available for some grant dollars through the FAA program that they have. So Alan's going to run through the details on this particular contract.
Thank you, Vince. Good morning, everybody. Pleasure to be here with you. As Vince said, I'm here to present the project for preconditioned air unit installation and request your approval to enter into a contract for roughly $3.9 million to get the work done. Just a visual for you, a preconditioned air unit is the air conditioning system basically that hangs off the belly of the passenger boarding bridge. What it can do is it can provide air to the aircraft while it's stationary, parked at the gate. So when you're taking a flight and you open the nozzle to cool yourself off a little bit before the flight or after you land, that's the system that's providing that air. Currently, many of our gates don't have a preconditioned air unit, and so we run, or excuse me, the aircraft runs its auxiliary power unit, which is basically a jet engine onboard the aircraft. It burns kerosene, thus creating a large amount of pollutants emissions, primarily particulates and carbon monoxide. So when we install preconditioned air units on these passenger boarding bridges, we allow the aircraft to shut down their auxiliary power units. Since the preconditioned air units are powered electrically, there are no on-site emissions. And because all of our electrical consumption here at PDX is offset with renewable energy credits, ultimately there are no emissions. We wipe out the emissions on the slate. The scope of the project is shown in this picture. All the red dots are the 27 gates where we will be installing preconditioned air units. The green dots are the existing PCAs. Primarily Alaska, United, and Southwest Airlines are utilizing them, just a couple gates on the Delta Concourse. There's a separate project that has already been approved by you folks. The Commission approved a project to replace passenger boarding bridges at four gates, and those are highlighted in blue, the B gates and D2 as well. Those new bridges will come with their own preconditioned air units. So this project that you're considering does not include those four gates. Schedule-wise, pending your folks' approval, we would enter into construction in October and be complete by the end of next August. As I mentioned earlier, the low bid is in the range of $3.9 million. It's with Strymer Sheet Metal Works. They're a local contractor. We're very pleased that they competed for the work. We have an additional $700,000 of port staff and design services and a contingency, so the total project budget is $5.4 million. I'm not sure if Vince mentioned it, but there is a component of this project that's really exciting, which is that we can get almost 55% of it paid for by the FAA. They operate a grant program called VAIL, stands for Voluntary Airport Low Emissions. So the FAA is willing to put some skin in the game, significant skin in the game, to underwrite the project to help airports improve their environmental impact, lower our footprints. The airlines have already committed to pick up the balance of the tab, so that's roughly $2.5 million for the airline cost share. So with that, I'd like to recommend that you folks approve the request of the executive director to enter into a contract with Strymer Sheet Metal Works for roughly $3.9 million to get this work done. And with that, any questions?
Questions? I've got one. There was, and it's been maybe 2 years ago now, a woman was in here testifying or talking to us about conditions on the aircraft in hot weather when they shut them down.
Cleaner.
Yeah. And so this seems like it would solve that problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. If that aircraft APU wasn't functional,
yeah,
and they had no ventilation,
yeah,
it's a bad situation.
Great.
To be in.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Motions.
I have a quick question. Strymer Sheet Metal Works, are they a local concern? Are they Oregon-based?
Yes.
Have you worked with them in the past?
I have not as a port employee, but in my prior career as a contractor in the market, yes. They're local to Portland, Southeast Portland.
Okay, and this is a concern that is engaged around our work with minority contractors and work to make sure that the kind
yes.
of economic impact here is favorable to...
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I understand that they'll be using O'Neill Electric as a subcontractor, which they exceeded the goal that we established for them for minority and disadvantaged business participation.
Great. Thank you.
You bet.
I have a question around the VAIL grant. You say that's here in the materials that you won't know for, I guess, a couple weeks or later this week?
Well, it should be today, actually. I called the FAA office in Seattle. They told me that the VAIL grant for the Boise Airport was offered yesterday and that they fully anticipate offering our grant today. Unfortunately, I couldn't come to the meeting with that in my back pocket. It should be today.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You bet.
Bob, Commissioner Levy, do you have a question?
Do each one of the airlines pay their own power bill at each one of the gates?
No, currently, as I understand it, it's all pooled and allocated out on a shared basis.
Like by passenger number? Or?
It's in their rent. So it's based on how much space that they rent. So that's a utility cost that just goes into their base rent.
Okay, thank you.
So motion, question?
To be clear, this is a heat pump unit that heats and cools air supplied to the plane?
It can provide heating and cooling. It's not technically a heat pump in the strictest sense, but yes, it's capable of both heating and cooling, using electricity for both.
Okay. I make a motion.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you very
carries.
Much.
Thanks very much for the presentation. And I think that's it. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.